Welcome to Airspace. I'm Nick Partridge.
I'm Emily Martin.
And I'm Matt Schindel.
Before we called it a glass ceiling, there was another kind of ceiling that women were trying to break through. Cloud cover.
Amelia Earhart made that her mission, but she wasn't alone.
In fact, she was part of a daring group of women who were walking on wings, flying under bridges, breaking altitude records, and racing across the country.
Initially, there were 99 of them.
Today, the story of the 99s.
We're going back to 1929, to the first Women's National Air Derby, where it all began.
And we'll also hear what the organization is up to today.
I wanted to be a bush pilot in Alaska, and my mother said, "No way, dear. Try nursing."
It's all coming up next on Airspace from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum with help from PRX. When I arrived here at the museum, I knew Amelia Earhart principally as a pilot who disappeared. And one of the surprising things that I learned was just how famous she was as a pilot before she disappeared.
But I think what's also really interesting is that we today now think of Amelia Earhart when we talk about women in aviation. But around the time that aviation was becoming a thing and becoming, you know, aviation was being populated by all these rock stars, Amelia Earhart wasn't the only rock star.
Yeah, I think more than most of the women in aeronautics at the time, she really wanted to build a community of women pilots, and she really wanted to promote an agenda of getting more women into the cockpit and flying. In fact, she was the first elected president of the 99s when they were founded. Whereas, you know, there were quite a few women flying at the time who weren't necessarily in it to break boundaries for all women, but were seeking their own personal fulfillment.
So, the first National Women's Air Derby. This was the first official women-only air race in the United States. It was a 9-day race from California to Ohio in 1929. One of the unifying factors of all these women, apart from the fact that they were very talented pilots, is that the more I read about them, the more intimidated I am. Early airplanes were not as safe and standard as we've become accustomed to in the modern era.
Yeah, you could say that they had pretty much no safety features. They were built just to accomplish the feat of flying in the air, which itself was, you know, pretty incredible.
But, you know, no GPS. Maybe they put a compass in there, but for the most part, you know, they'd hang a plumb bob or some their house keys or something in the front to kind of get a sense of, like, which way was down. There were no lights on the front of the airplanes, and your wings were made out of canvas, and no radios. So if, you know, if they ever had any trouble, they had to land usually in some kind of field.
Yeah.
And apparently, cows really like the taste of lacquer on the wings of these airplanes.
I could see lacquer being tasty. Did anyone never eat glue over the course of their life?
No.
There's always the kid in class who eats paste. Yeah, that was you?
No.
Ooh, I don't believe you.
So there was no AAA. There was no, I've got a flat tire, and I'm not dressed to change it myself. Does anyone want to come fix this for me? You really had to be your own person.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there were not only not a lot of airports at this time, and you're flying around in these tuna fish cans that are really pretty unreliable.
Landing in fields, trying not to be eaten by cows.
Right. Mm-hmm. But
this would make a great video game.
But it also means when you land in a field and you're trying to avoid getting your plane eaten by cows, you also have to try and fix the problem. Pilots in general not only had to be accomplished flyers, they also had to be accomplished mechanics. And there was a big to-do during the organization of the first Women's National Air Derby because the organizers really wanted the women to fly with mechanics, partly for their own safety, partly because they just didn't think that they could do it. And the women really fought tooth and nail to make sure that they could fly this derby solo because they wanted to make sure that the men weren't going to get the credit for their accomplishments.
We were in sort of yellow journalism at the time. So often the women were referred to as petticoat pilots, as flying flappers, as ladybird pilots.
That's Heather Taylor. She's the producer of the documentary Breaking Through the Clouds, the first Women's National Air Derby.
The first Women's National Air Derby was a 9-day air race that began in Santa Monica, California on August 18, 1929, and ended in Cleveland, Ohio on August 26th. There were 20 women initially entered into the Derby on race day, and 14 ended up in Cleveland by the end of the race 9 days later. Aviation was at the precipice. This was sort of the apex of all that was happening between technology, between some of women's rights, between the manufacturing of airplanes. Women earned the right to vote in 1920, and that was building. There was a bit of the jazz age and the freedom and a bit of excitement really building at this time. And I think the women sort of got caught up and captured that for the country.
What a wonderful woman. And isn't she like Lindbergh? And there's her little plane with which she's broken all records and crossed the Atlantic in 13 and a half hours.
And initially, didn't the organizers want the women exclusively to fly in sort of smaller, lighter planes because it was more appropriate?
Right. Initially, some of the rules, the men suggested that the women fly only in light class planes, which meant smaller engines and smaller planes. They felt that was more of a safety issue for the women. And of course, the women said, no, we can fly whatever you throw at us.
Can you describe how this takeoff works and what it was like on that first day of the Derby?
The first day of the Derby, opening day, was a madhouse. It was over 30,000 people at the Santa Monica Airport. People were sitting on the roofs of their barns going up to the airport. There was a long line to get into the race. It was just crazy, and people were bringing picnic baskets, and little boys were flying paper airplanes, and all kinds of festivities. You can almost smell the popcorn and the peanuts as you and hear the whirling of the propellers as you're there.
All right, here we go, folks. All right.
They were all officially introduced.
I want to introduce some of the greatest flyers in the history of aviation, the women flyers who are going to be contestants in the great National Women's Air Derby.
So the first woman to take off would be Phoebe Omley.
Can you kind of give us a picture of Phoebe as a person and her accomplishments?
Yeah, Phoebe Omley is so underrecognized and one of the most astonishing pilots. But in order to make money to buy an airplane and do all that you had to do, she did a lot of wing walking. So she walked on the wings of the airplane. She hung underneath with just her biting a leather strap underneath the airplane and just hanging underneath. I mean, she was insane. She did parachute jumping. During the Derby, she was walking with a cane from a previous accident.
Okay.
So Phoebe Omley was the first female pilot to earn an AMP, which is basically a mechanic's license, in 1927 is when she earned that.
Well, Marvel, I'm certainly going to try to win this race, but if I don't, I hope you do.
Well, thanks, Pancho. May your landings all be slow and low.
If you're going to talk about big personalities, I think...
Pancho
Barnes, right? Biggest personality of the group.
Yeah, Pancho is a walking contradiction. She was raised in a very wealthy Pasadena, California, in a very wealthy Victorian home. Her mother wanted her to go to finishing school and be a proper young lady. And Pancho, from the moment she was out of the womb, was riding riding horses, standing up on the horse's back and riding them. You know, she was not one to be contained. And there was actually a prearranged marriage her parents made for to an Episcopal preacher. And that didn't go over well. In fact, later, when Pancho had sort of come into herself and established who she was, she was known for her swearing and her short hair and her smoking cigars and being as outlandish. She was as outlandish as she could be, but she had a heart of gold and was always helping people. But at one point, when her husband, the Episcopal preacher, who was administering to some of his parishioners in ways that were not maybe Christian.
Yes, that is a euphemism. It is the euphemism you think it is.
Yeah. She would wait till the Sunday services and buzz the church.
I love that part. That's probably one of my favorite stories about her. What are some of the expectations of these female pilots?
Right. So in some ways, the women in the Derby were looked at as a novelty. One of the big things in the air race that was always commented on in the papers or in the radio was that these women were wearing pants. What they wore and how they looked was reported on way more than how they flew.
Yeah, I mean, that's nothing nothing's changed, right?
Right.
I mean, hashtag ask her more, right? I mean,
right.
That's a big issue still these days. And the women weren't really just facing the dangers of the elements, the dangers of early aviation and the challenges that came along with simply having early airplanes, right? But there was this issue of sabotage. It was a really big player in this race.
Sabotage was a big issue in this race, and there's a lot of speculation. The second day of the air race, there were four accidents, and one of them resulted in the death of the pilot. On that same day, Bobby Trout crashed in about the same area near Calexico. They said she ran out of gas, but she was an expert in gas maintenance, and she fueled up in San Bernardino. Thea Rash had also landed and had dirt in her gas tank. You know, engines weren't super reliable in 1929. So you can give a reason for every one of these accidents, but when you put them all together, and again, we didn't have NTSB at that time.
So Louise Thaden won the race, and a few months later, the 99s held their first meeting. How did this race precipitate the formation of the 99s?
There's a legend that the women gathered on the second day after they arrived under the bleachers and said that we need to form an organization. We've had such a good time and this has been such a success that we need to keep supporting each other as women pilots. They had their personality, their guts, and each other.
There's one thing that stands out in this race, and that is that all the girls are good sports. It's been a pleasure to be in it to meet the other girls.
There are definitely, each of the women has sort of a different variation of what happened and how it started, but the genesis was most certainly the first Women's National Air Derby, and almost all of these women were charter members of the organization.
Wait, were there 99 original members or were there 99 people that answered the call to the original meeting?
99 original charter members.
Yes.
Yes. We talk about the film The Right Stuff on this podcast, what, every other episode at least?
Yes,
it's a long movie. We're still only in the
first
third.
Yeah.
It comes up a lot. And when it was brought to my attention that the bartender in that movie is Poncha Barnes, I'm starting to think about, gosh, what her sort of aristocratic Pasadena, California family would feel about her running a bar for a bunch of test pilots.
If you're just picturing a bartender from Pasadena, California, I don't think you're getting the full character sketch.
I think if you think about a female pilot from Pasadena, California, you definitely aren't getting the full sketch.
And if you haven't seen the movie, we're describing kind of an elder stateswoman, even at that time, who has this powerful, intimidating presence over, and I can't overstate how difficult this is to cultivate, test pilots at Edwards Air Force Base in the late 1940s.
Hey, Poncha.
Mm.
I was looking at the pictures on your wall, and I was wondering how come a fancy pilot like Slick over there doesn't have his picture up there? What do you have to do to get your picture up there anyway?
You have to die, sweetie.
Well, and Poncho is kind of really well known for her outlandish outfits in a lot of ways. So getting into some of these airplanes wearing a skirt or high heels is kind of really impractical. So as a woman pilot, they kind of had to figure out ways to make that work. And for most of them, that meant wearing some kind of riding pants or jot hoppers or something in order to be really practical. But Poncho Barnes was really well known for not always wearing her pants just because it was practical for when she was flying. She actually wore them on and off the runway. Ha! Ba-dum-tsh! The runway.
Oh, damn. All right. Yeah, no, it took a second.
Nick just got there.
Yeah,
Nick
just got there. That's good. That's solid.
Thanks.
That is a structurally sound joke.
Can I tell you that I did it and then I realized it was a joke? I didn't even do it on purpose.
We're going to take a short break, but stick with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about what the 99s are doing today. And by that, I mean taking Emily on a discovery flight.
Bobby Trout and Luke Nichols, neck and neck in the Women's National Air Race.
So guess what percentage of commercial pilots are women? Anyone?
Is it 6% or is it under 6%?
I like this. 6.33% if you count helicopter pilots.
Jeez, that's really okay. Yeah. I don't have blinders on.
No, seriously, it's about 6% of commercial airline pilots are women.
6%.
6%.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually related to women pilots being barred from flying combat missions until more recently. The Air Force didn't admit women into pilot training until 1976, and they couldn't train as fighter pilots until 1993.
So 6% of modern commercial pilots are women. That is a horrifying statistic.
Yeah, and if you look at all licensed pilots, it's only 7%, which isn't much better.
So clearly there is still a role for an organization like the 99s. What are they up to today?
Well, their role hasn't changed an awful lot in that they're still trying to promote women in aviation. They work really hard to foster their endowment, which they use to support scholarships. But, you know, it's not just about getting young women excited about aviation and maybe even pursuing a pilot's license. It's partly driven by using aviation as a way of getting young women excited about a career that is air adjacent or space adjacent or STEM adjacent.
So one of the things that the 99s do today is they mentor young pilots. They offer scholarships, like Emily said, and they also organize discovery flights so that girls can have an opportunity to go up in a small plane and experience the excitement.
Yeah, actually, I was able to go on my own discovery flight thanks to the 99s. And while I'm not a small kid anymore, I've never been in a small single-engine plane.
I'm Judy Shawn. I'm a 99. I've been a 99 since about 2011 and thoroughly enjoy the company of other women pilots. There are so few female pilots today, particularly because it's never been encouraged. I can remember back when I started, I wanted to be a bush pilot in Alaska, and my mother said, "No way, dear. Try nursing or some other profession like that." And my first small plane, would have been probably a glider. I just loved being in the air. It was just fantastic.
I met Judy at Leesburg Airport, which is about 40 miles west of Washington, D.C. She drove us to a hangar and opened the door to a little four-seater airplane. They called it the Ferrari of planes because it has a very special feature.
We are going to be flying in a Cirrus SR-20. Cirrus is a plane that has its own parachute, and if you ever get into trouble, there is a red handle in the ceiling that you just reach up and pull, and it will land the whole plane.
Okay, ready to get on board?
Sure. I love how the whole wall of this airplane hangar just opened up. Judy just pulled the airplane out by herself, the whole airplane. Then she drove her Prius inside, and then they closed the wall of the airplane hangar, and now they're coming out of the little Hobbit door in the side. There was one more person with us, Justin Lungoski. He's an instructor, and he came along to help Judy keep her instrument rating current. If you're instrument rated, you can fly in conditions where there's no visibility, for example, when you fly inside clouds. Everything I want to step on to get onto this airplane says no step.
There's a handle there.
Jackpot.
You found your seat belts back there?
Yes, I am buckled in.
The handle for the parachute is here.
Okay.
If you ever need it, you just reach up and pull down with about 40 pounds of force.
Okay.
And it'll release the parachute.
We taxied to the runway.
You excited? Zip it out.
Frequency 125.05, squawk 4650, holding for release.
Leesburg traffic, Cirrus 826 Mike Sierra, departing runway 17 Leesburg.
Leesburg.
And we took off. Before you knew it, we were cruising over farmland and some new housing developments in the suburbs of D.C. It was a neat experience being able to actually see sort of 180 degrees around you. The small plane actually had a lot of windows.
The altimeter is set for 2998.
We headed for Culpeper. That's about a 40-minute flight. Judy wanted to go there because they have a compass rose that the 99s painted 15 years ago, and it needs repainting.
Compass rose is essentially a compass painted on the taxiway usually. And for the 99s, it has our logo in the center. It's also got the cardinal points marked out on it. And it legally has to be surveyed so that it actually points north, because planes are allowed to legally swing their compasses, as in align their compass in their plane, by lining up with the compass on the runway. And plus, it's kind of neat to fly over an airport that has a compass rose, because you can see it very clearly from the air.
As we were flying towards Culpeper, Justin pointed to the screen on the dashboard that shows all the weather patterns, and he put his finger on this big red spot. And he said, "That's actually not good for us." It was a thunderstorm right in our path, potentially with a lot of lightning, and we had to stay away from it.
We're seeing a cell just south of Culpeper. We're thinking about canceling IFR and returning back to Leesburg.
Oh, that's too bad. Oh, well. Best laid plans. Mike Sierra is 8 miles to the southwest, inbound for landing 17. We'll be overflying midfield.
A little while later, we landed in Leesburg.
That's airspeed. Pitch down, increase power.
It was a really smooth landing.
That's how you do it.
826 Mike Sierra is clear the runway.
And we taxied back to the hangar.
Oh, you ladies want to deplane?
We wiped bug smudges off the plane and had it refueled.
How was the ride comfortable back there?
Yeah, I got a little green behind the gills towards the end, but yeah, I know.
I know. I don't think it had anything to do with the driver. So we didn't see the compass rose, but with Judy, it's pretty clear that any day you get to fly is a good day. This is a woman who will meet up with some friends at the airport, jump into a plane, and fly to Pennsylvania for dinner, and then fly back. Basically, she just loves to fly. What's your favorite part about it?
It's actually being just above the clouds where you're, you know, free of the updrafts. But there's this puffy, like cotton batony stuff all underneath you. And you don't see anything else but blue sky and white. And I think, to me, that's incredibly beautiful.
And Judy says flying is a lot more accessible to women and girls these days. In fact, the same morning we were at Leesburg Airport, a group of girls from the museum's aviation summer camp were taking their first flight in a small plane.
When I was up in the air, it felt unreal.
In a car, like, you can go anywhere, but there's certain roads and paths that you have to follow and rules. In a plane, you can just go anywhere in a circle, you can do a flip, you can do anything that you really want to do in a plane.
And it felt like you were just a giant in the middle of the air, just walking around.
Buildings were like little toy buildings that you could build with Legos, and the car looked like little toy cars that you can buy from Toys R Us. So it's definitely like, it's different from up there.
And that's a very traditional way for someone to get into a lifelong pursuit of aviation. You read about all of the astronauts having taken one first flight, and they can pinpoint someone landing in a field near their house and taking a few bucks and taking them up, and they were 6 or 7 years old, and then they're landing on the moon a couple of decades later.
So Eileen Collins in 1995 was the first NASA female pilot to actually pilot a space shuttle up into space.
Did she bring anything cool with her?
Yeah, she actually brought Amelia Earhart's scarf, or one of her scarves. We can assume that Amelia Earhart had more than one.
If she didn't, that's a whole episode.
Yeah, yeah. She refused to buy a second scarf.
She carried mementos from early women aviators, all of whom were in the 99s, on a couple of her flights.
That's right. For example, she carried Bobby Trout's pilot license with her, and Bobby Trout was one of the founding charter members of the 99s. She raced in that original air derby, and she broke all kinds of records for endurance as a pilot.
Her pilot's license was signed by Orville Wright himself, right?
As were all the pilot's licenses at that time.
Emily.
Yo.
What did you discover on your discovery flight? What didn't you know before?
I didn't know the view could be that good, because it's always that tiny little window, right? That you see in like a commercial jet where you're like, oh, I guess I can sort of see like by looking across this person's lap.
You got the whole vista this time?
You get the whole vista. You get almost 180 degrees, which is pretty spectacular. I also discovered that being in a smaller plane does not make me less airsick. However, every time I meet somebody who can fly a plane, especially a female pilot, their story as to what romanced them into the idea of wanting to get their pilot's license, whether it be something practical or something really like special to them, they're some of the coolest people you'll ever meet. And so I not only got to discover a really awesome view, I got to meet another really rad person and fly in a very rad plane. And I'm incredibly encouraged that there is an organization out there like the 99s who are working really hard to encourage women and girls to pursue their pilot's license. And if they don't pursue their pilot's license, just to get them excited about something, especially something that's in a field or might be in a field that's not generally female dominated.
Did you catch the bug? Are you going to be a pilot now?
No, I'm going to be an enthusiastic passenger. With lots of Dramamine.
That's it for this episode of Airspace. We're working on our next episode now about the space agencies of other countries.
Special thanks to our producer this month, Ruth Morris. The Airspace team behind the scenes is Katie Moyer, Lizzie Peabody, Tarek Fuda, Jason Orfanen, John Barth, and Genevieve Sponsler.
Special thanks to PRX and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. More information at sloan.org. The young girls you heard right after their discovery flight were Kylie Hernandez and Brielle Pyram. Archival clips from the first Women's National Air Derby are courtesy of Heather Taylor and Archetypal Images. You can subscribe to Airspace wherever you get your podcasts, and please, tell a friend. Bring a wingmate.
All right, well, I'm most awfully happy to be here. It was a tubbing flight today, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But last night wasn't so hot. It was just bad luck that I broke a valve and had to sit down in a big field and amongst a lot of cows and pigs and horses. But this morning we had to shoo all the pigs into a corner of the field, and I think all the inhabitants of Xenia came out. And anyhow, it was great to get away, and I'm awfully happy to be here, and I've loved the air race.
From PRX.